WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and just because we can doesn't mean we should. That's sort of the basic premise of bioethics as we forge ahead into the future with really incredible medical advances. Medical ethics becomes more and more complex. So starting now, a new series, Ask a Bioethicist. Each week this month, we'll tackle some of the thorniest bioethical questions with Duke University Professor Nita Farahani, member of the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. We'll talk about the philosophical, moral, and legal questions surrounding issues like genetics and privacy and neuroscience. Today's topic is reproductive technology. Nita Farahani, welcome to WNYC, and thank you so much for doing this series with us.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to share my personal views with you and your listeners.
And listeners, we can take some of your bioethical questions at 212-433-WNYC in the area today of reproductive technology, 212-433-9692. And over the weekend, we asked our crowd to suggest some bioethical questions for us to tackle today within the realm of reproductive technology. And so we'll dive into some of those that we got on Facebook and Twitter and on our website. So let's do that right now. Amanda on Facebook, Dr. Farahani, asks a really fundamental question. Is it a right to reproduce? Should insurance companies, public and private, be required to pay for assistive reproductive technologies? Those technologies would include fertility drugs and in vitro fertilization. And one thing is that it's really interesting to me that a right is defined as what the law requires insurance companies to pay for. but at that level, what is your personal opinion as a bioethicist? Is reproducing a right, or at least should it be covered by insurance?
So, Brian, I think it's right to separate those two questions. The first one is there a right to reproduce? And the second one is, should insurance companies be required to pay for it? And the reason I think it makes sense to divide those two issues up is the first question we can think of as two separate things. One is, do you have a right to not be interfered with when you make a choice to reproduce versus is there some positive right that you should be enabled to do so by the government? And I think we have clearly established both a norm as well as legal protections to not be interfered with in a decision to reproduce. But that's really a very different thing than is there a positive right? Should the government require insurance companies to pay for those technologies, whether they're assistive reproductive technologies or anything else? And I think the answer to that is no. We don't require insurance companies to safeguard that. It's really a negative right against non-interference, not a positive right to have everything provided to you to make that possible.
I guess it becomes, if somebody's going to push back on that, a question of class privilege and whether we should allow class privilege for something that's available in an area as fundamental as being able to have a baby, right? Because in vitro costs something like $10,000 to $12,000 each time you try, and it often doesn't work the first time. But without that kind of a law, only richer people can avail themselves of that privilege.
Well, a couple of answers to that. One is a right to have a child doesn't necessarily mean a right to have your own genetic child. And for people who are unable to have their own genetic children, that doesn't mean that we as a society will decide to pay for the ability to have access to reproductive technologies, which doesn't mean we couldn't as a society. If we decided that there was nothing more fundamental than the individual interest in having their own genetic children, then maybe we would as a society pay for it. But that's not a choice we've made. Mm-hmm. And in part, it's because there are other options available besides simply assistive reproductive technologies to have your own genetic child.
And looking at the data I have in front of me, it seems like 15 states have made that choice, including New York and Connecticut, but not New Jersey. Coverage of infertility treatment is mandated in those 15 states, including New York and Connecticut, but not in the other 35. Terry in South – yeah, go ahead.
Well, what that means, though, it varies by state, right? So to say that an insurance company has to pay some amount toward assisted reproductive technology could be something as simple as, you know, providing different types of treatments to women, or it could mean things like the full suite of in vitro fertilization and assistance to a male as well. It varies quite a bit, you know, state by state, and exactly how much is covered and whether it's enough for assisted reproductive technologies varies widely.
All right, let's take another reproductive technology bioethical question. Terry in South Orange is calling in. Hi, Terry, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about the ethics of permitting a woman who is actively undergoing cancer treatment that is making fertility an issue, allowing her access to reproductive technologies, and both what are the ethics with regard to the medical stuff, but also just the larger picture of ethically a woman who is facing cancer, and whether just the issues that are related to reproductive technologies and women who are sick.
Is she terminal, or do you know what her chances of long-term survival are?
I'm not asking interestingly about a particular person.
Uh-huh.
It's the broader picture about the question, since there are so many younger and younger women who are facing treatment for cancer, which allows them to live much longer lives than they would have otherwise, but who have an uncertain future. And because of their cancer treatment, they're left infertile and can be helped by reproductive technology.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Farahani, is this a question you've grappled with?
It is indeed. So, you know, there's Brian, you go to one of the questions that, of course, we need to ask, which is the person terminal? But before we even get to that question, you know, assuming that, as Terry says, this is a person who could continue to have a long life and their fertility could be sacrificed by the chemotherapy or other cancer treatments that they would undergo, what are the ethics involved? So first is you generally don't want to give certain types of cancer, people who are undergoing certain types of cancer, hormones that are associated with in vitro fertilization during their cancer treatments because it can make the cancer far worse. So it puts a woman in a very difficult position of deciding between her own personal health and the ability to reproduce. Assuming you could safely do something to preserve her fertility, like freezing eggs, this is something that most insurance companies will cover because there's a medical necessity for preserving fertility at that moment in time. But then the separate question is, once you've done that, assume that you've successfully been able to go through the process of egg freezing for a woman undergoing cancer treatments, what are the longer term implications for her ability to carry a child to term? And it really depends on the safety and efficacy of being able to do so. Cancer treatments can affect your reproductive organs. It can affect your ability to have a child without birth defects. And we have to ask the question of, are you likely to be a parent and guardian to this child into adulthood, given your own health?
Chris in Brooklyn is a reproductive psychologist and wants to weigh in on this question. Do I have that right, Chris?
That's absolutely right. I think we have. I do see cancer patients who are undergoing infertility treatment, both men and women. And I think we have to be extremely careful that we don't discriminate against them. I think that in many cases, the patients we see, by the time we see them, their infertility, they're already infertile because the cancer has compromised them in one way or another. Yes, we can freeze eggs. for the most part, insurance does not pay for this. And there are programs, both experimental and compassionate by hospitals throughout the country, where they are reduced. There are reduced rates, and I'm part of one of those programs where we will help women freeze sections of their ovaries, freeze eggs, to help them have future fertility. And before they go through treatment in the future, we do want to see a clearance letter from their oncologist. Nobody can predict the future. Nobody can predict the quality of their sperm or their eggs as they go forward. But I think they do have the, we have the right to listen to them, we have the right to assess them, and to help them become full human beings mm-hmm. without discriminating against them right. because of their cancer diagnosis.
Chris, thank you. One last thought on that, Dr. Farahani, you think that's too liberal?
I don't think it's too liberal. I think that Chris is absolutely right that we shouldn't discriminate against people because of their infertilities, whether that infertility arises from cancer treatments or cancer itself or any other condition. But we do need to think about what's in the best interest of the resulting child when we make these choices as well. And I think one thing that's often lost in the reproductive technologies debate is a focus almost exclusively on the parents rather than considering what the implications might be for the resulting child. And as a society, I think we have a greater interest in the areas of reproductive technologies than we do in reproduction without reproductive technologies.
This is day one in our month-long March series, one a week through the month of March. Ask a bioethicist today on reproductive technology ethical questions with Nita Farahani, member of the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues and a professor at Duke University, and Bob in Rego Park. You're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Ryan, how you doing, guy? Continue to do an amazing job. I'd like to ask you a question. I used to coach basketball. Does the professor feel as though it would be ethical for a parent, especially if they have money, to take an egg from a woman who's 6'4" and find a sperm of a guy who's 7'6", create a human being, an 8-foot center for Duke University or the NBA, and as you know, money and the genetics, this will allow it to occur. Do you think the government should say, no, we can't get into this? That's my question.
Thank you, Bob. And I guess really to expand the question, it gets into any genetic selection that we have control over for any trait that we can consider advantageous to our children for any reason. Right, Dr. Farahani?
I think that's right. But let's start first with the example that was given. So let me say, just as a side note, that happily, I don't think the Duke basketball team needs that kind of help. But that being said, you know, the question is, what limits, if any, should society place on genetic engineering? And I think we should start with an understanding of what genetic engineering is. So there's very little that we can do today. We can primarily just do something around mitochondrial DNA, which is the DNA outside of the nucleus of the cell. The nucleus of the cell is where 99.9% of behavioral traits that have a genetic contribution is actually encoded. And so the question really is, once we can do something in nuclear DNA, should you be able to do absolutely anything you want? And in general, this doesn't seem to be what parents are looking to do. Parents are most interested in health-promoting genes, not in trying to do things like have the tallest possible child or a child with particular intelligence or particular eye color. But suppose we got to that place in the world. Suppose we got to the place where we could do that, or you could do something as simple as, you know, choose the best possible height-promoting genes from one woman and the height-promoting genes from one man, combine them and have a particular offspring. Should we do that? Right. That's the question. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that is it really depends on what we hope to achieve as a society. I think if we ever got to the point where we could guarantee the safety and efficacy of genetic engineering, then we'd really have to ask hard questions about what's the interest of the individual versus what's the interest of society. We have a long way to go before we ever get there.
Well, there's now PGD, which stands for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which allows you to screen an embryo for specific genetic diseases before the embryos are implanted. It's used with IVF, and it's, as you know, a huge medical advance that allows people with, say, Huntington's disease to screen that gene entirely out to ensure your child doesn't carry that gene. But it also theoretically makes it possible to choose the gender of your baby and other characteristics that don't have to do with health. So what do you think? Is that the same question?
So first of all, I'd say it's not just theoretical. People are already screening for traits beyond things like certain diseases. So gender selection is already happening in a number of reproductive clinics across the country. And it's an interesting example because instead of people trying to select for the most, you know, outlandish or discriminatory traits you could imagine, what they're trying to do when they do sex selection is often balance a family. They already have three boys, for example, and they want a daughter. So they're choosing to reproduce for a daughter instead of for a male. And, you know, those are the types of choices people are making. Can they do the same thing with PGD that they could do with genetic engineering? Not quite, because with PGD, you're limited to the genetic contributions of the mother and the father, whereas with genetic engineering, you could actually take traits from other individuals in the population that the two parents don't have and change the genetic structure of the embryo to have those traits instead. So you're limited to your own genes in PGD in a way that you're not in genetic engineering.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes left for this first session of Ask a Bioethicist. And I'll throw in one more question to you from another one of our Facebook fans, Amy on Facebook, because we can solve ethical quandaries in 60 seconds, can't we? The 60-second bioethicist, to whom Amy asks, should there be an age limit on men using reproductive technology? Recent studies show that autism may be related to the age of the father. So first of all, are there ethical or legal guidelines with respect to women, and do you think they should be the same or different with respect to men?
So other countries have adopted age limits for the use of in vitro fertilization for women. And older parenthood raises a number of really important factual and ethical questions, not all of which we can deal with today. But some of those questions for people to think about are issues like the safety, economic, and psychological impact of these practices on children and parents. Whether it's a male parent or a female parent, there are issues for both the children and the longevity of the parents that we have to take into account in thinking about the use of these reproductive technologies in older parents.
Well, there we will leave it for today with Nita Farahani, professor of law and philosophy and professor of genome sciences and policy at Duke University, whose basketball team needs no genetic help. She's also a member of the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues, though she's been presenting here her views as an individual bioethics specialist, certainly not speaking for the president or the commission. And she'll be with us each week this month. Next week, we're going to talk about privacy and genetics. So listeners, if you have any questions for her along those lines, privacy and genetics, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show and post that question. And we'll put out a Facebook and Twitter ask for that as well. Dr. Farahani, a fascinating start. I'm sure you made many, many people think more deeply about things than they've thought before about some of these questions. So thank you, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.